We begin with young adult, age period to 35 years of age. Now, the young adult, they have what we call expected growth. For them, they still go through expected growth and development, even at that age. Now, growth and development are not the same. So, growth ends at age 20. You will keep growing. Your body parts, your body organs will keep growing. And they will keep growing from the day you or your parents had the brought forth a pregnancy, or your mom had you in her belly or in utero, as you may call it. You're going to keep growing from that point in time up to 20 years of age. At 20 years of age, growth has ended. We do not expect growth. If you did not grow one, if you did not reach to, you stop at 6.9 inches tall, or you stop at 6'9", at 20 years old, you stop right there. If your size was size 8.5, at age 20, it stopped growing. That's what happened in there. So growth is concluded by the age of 20. Now, there are physical senses we still have. And if those senses we have physically, they reach their peak at age 20, between this particular age. Our senses to perceive things, to understand the world, to look at around, to look around us and find out how the world is moving around, to have a full idea of what we want to do in our life, in our world, in our cycle, is a beginning. That's when it is fully activated, between age 20 to age 35, which is the young adult age. Our cardiac output and efficiency reaches a peak. At that point in time, our heart reaches its peak to pump our blood and other things to other part of the body. That is where exactly our heart will reach its peak at that particular point in time. Our muscles functions will be fully 100% at age 25. Our muscle function will reach its peak at age 25 at this stage. Now, then our metabolic rate would decrease by 2% to 4% every decade after the age 20. So at the age 20, so this is our metabolic rate, Now this is a graph here. It starts at this point when we are born. It will keep increasing. Here is the age range. This is age 20. So it's going to keep going up from this point. There will be a rise in our metabolic rate, it will keep going up. When it reaches the age of, at this point, at 20, it has reached its maximum level. At age 20, after every 10 years, our body metabolism will drop by 2 to 4% every decade. So now, here we have 30 years, here we have 40, here we have 50. So what happened is that at this stage, it has reached its peak, it begins to decline by every 10 years it declines, until we die, or until it collapses, and then we leave the earth. So this is how what happened to us. So that's why you will see a 70-year-old eating, running, doing everything. The moment the person reaches the age of 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, you will see a decline will come in. And as age progresses, our metabolism will also decrease. That's what happened in age. Now, at this stage, it is where our libido, our drive for sex is at its peak. at age 25, our drive for sex for both male and female reaches its peak at the age of young adulthood. Libido for women peaks during the later part of this stage. Now, men and women will not have the same peak of libido, sexual drive at the same age. Men will reach their peak at an earlier age. Women will sort of reach that peak of sexual activeness at the age, maybe at the later part of this particular 25 years going downward. That's when females reach their peak and they're gonna have a high libidinal drive. Male will start at 20 to 35. At that point, then we'll have the biggest peak. Women will start at least from age 30 towards 25. So the female only comes in later than the male. Now, then this is the time for childbearing. This is the point at which every female wants to have a child between this age. At this age, our system is superb. Our body speaks a lot, and we understand our body. We have complete control over our system at this age. The moment we pass the age 25, our systems start to shut down. We start to get out of control for our system. We cannot have the adequate control we had over our system as females when we were between the age 18 to 25, from 20 to 30, from 30 to 35. At that point in time, a lot of hormonal changes will come with complications. That's why females are always told to bond the children between age 100 to age 35. After 35, yes, you can still have kids, but it comes with so much different complications. Now, Piaget talked about this age. In Piaget's work, he said this age is what we call the formal operational age. At this stage, you are having what we call formal operation at this particular young adulthood. You are having a formal operational age range. That's what's happening in here. Now, the young adult years are an optimal time for education for both formal and informal. It's wherein we learn so much skills, we understand the world. We have so much experiences when it comes to parenting. Our memory will reach a peak at the age of 20. After 25, after this age, our memory will start to decline. Our memory will not be sharp like how it was in our 20s. We'll have decline in that. Our ability to be creative, to have creativity in our thought process comes in at this age. Then, according to Erickson, young adults have what we call intimacy versus isolation. That's the conflict we have at this stage. We have intimacy versus isolation under here. Now, it is the point in which your son, your daughter wants to have an intimate relationship to herself. We crave for love. We want to have belonging. We want to have a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a husband, or a wife that would be answerable to us. Hey, babe, where are you? What are you doing? When are you going to be home? These things come in at this particular age range. Now, if we cannot achieve them, people turn us to be what? We are weird and we are isolated. Now, because at this age, if we cannot get around people, sometimes it's not really about having intimate relationship with other or the opposite sex. We find the true meaning of friendship, casual friendship, a cordial relationship, casual one, that we understand each other. We find that in this particular age range. Now, during this point, the young adult can take on more other commitments and responsibilities at this stage. They will take on more. During this stage, the young adults can have occupational choices, like can set up goals, like how we are doing. I want to be a nurse. I want to be a doctor.
I want to be an engineer. So I'm going to search for school that offer a nursing program. I want to go to this school. Now, this is the point in which we become wholly and sort of goal-oriented at this particular young adult age. Now, under here, we want to experiment things that we've been trying to do. Okay, sometimes people just take courses and go to school. Take some courses and do some courses. You can also have the comfort that you don't understand what you want to do. So because of that, you want to take courses at a college to keep going for 1 or 2 months or at least a year to figure out what you want to do. This comes in at this young adult age. For the young adult also, we sort of have what we call moral development. Young adult can personalize values and beliefs. It's wherein we can choose whether we want to stay be a Muslim or want to convert to Christianity, or want to still be a Christian or want to convert to being a Muslim. It's when you understand the world. Okay, I want to be an atheist. I don't think God exists. I don't believe in religion. I believe in spirituality. That's when these things come. Okay, I choose to be a gay because I don't think the opposite sex relationship can help me. I want to be a gay. I feel like my same sex partner can love me. He wouldn't cheat on me. So I want to be a gay. I want to be a same sex person. I don't want to be straight anymore. Now, this decision comes in at this point. Yes, still in America today, it comes in at an early age. You will see kids who are what we call neutral gender. They have not decided which role to take. They're still fighting to have gender identity. They still want to understand that am I really a female or am I really a male? So for that reason, we do not call them by gender pronoun sensitive. If a person is a male, we call them it. We call them generally, we don't call them he or she because he or she is still fighting to identify himself or herself with a particular gender. If it goes in the long run and he starts to be a female gender, we want to call him she. He goes in, changes his name, and do other things. If his name is not changed, he can still do other things. He can change his biomorphology, his other thing, he becomes a transgender. So these things occur at this stage, yet still sometimes it will occur at an early age, but it is where you will have that particular mentality that you have understood the world and you want to make the decision. So at this stage, these young adults view their body image. Their view is affected by diet and exercise patterns. You see young adults going to the gym, they want to be sexy, they want to have six packs, they want to be muscular, they want to have a very unique physique. These are things they want to have. So based upon this, you will see them doing all these things to make sure they are in the right position at the right time. They're going to do these things. At this stage also, we do a routine clinical visit to see other things. Our nutrition, our food we eat, we have to monitor our nutrition, our physical activities. We want to monitor our calcium intake for women because at this stage, women can have so much regular flow of menses, which can reduce the strength of their bones and put it at risk for so many different kinds of complications. So dietary management in this stage is very important. We come down with so many of our conditions at this stage. At this stage, the symptoms of heart failure, heart problems start to kick in at this stage. So at this stage, we want to watch out what we eat, how we live our life, what we do with our life. It is important at this stage because we inherit the condition, we bring this condition out in our life at this particular young adult stage. Any question on the stage? Now, then we have the middle adult. Somebody's phone is on, you keep disturbing us. I put it on mute and you still put it off mute. Middle adult age is from 35 to 65. The middle adult age, there is decreases decreases occurring. So we begin to decrease in so many aspects of our lives at this age. At this age, after 35, you're no longer a kid. You start to decline in so many things. In your eyesight, the way you urinate will change, the way you do things, the way you will run around to not feel pain will change. That's why the athletes, footballers, soccer players, basketball, at the age of 35, things start to like decrease your wages. Because 35, you have less than 5 years to play any active sport. Anyone who play active physical sport at 40, maybe you are gifted, you are extraordinary. So at this stage, there's a huge decline in our body structure. Our skin turnover, we want to start to have poor skin turnover at this age. We want to start to have more subcutaneous fats coming in. We want to start to have melanin. There will be a decrease in our melanin in our hair. So when our hair lost the melanin, our hair lost the melanin, then we start to have gray hair. So gray hair will kick in at this stage. Don't get me wrong, there are people who are younger who have gray hair. That is not a decline in age due to gray hair, or gray hair due to decline age. No, that is different. But when you pass 35, that's when the melanin, what creates the blackness in your hair, will decline. Then you sort of have gray hair coming in your hair. We sort of have decrease in our hair. We sort of get bald at this age, or the extreme baldness. Then our visual equity will start to decline. Our eyesight will not be like before in this young adult age. Our height our bones will start to come together and will start to get shorter and shorter and shorter until we start to walk like we have hunchback or we have some scoliosis or something else of the fatty mark. We're going to have a decreased calcium and decreased bone density. We're going to have some decrease in our gastric secretion. So our appetite will decrease. The manner in which we used to eat and get hungry so fast is not going to be like before, because those gastric juices, the hydrochloric acid, the pepsin, gastrins that are in our stomach, that's supposed to help to cause digestion for us so fast, there is a decrease in those gastric content. Based on that, we cannot have the much faster metabolism we had between the age 20 to 35. We also start to have decrease in our glomerular filtration rate. That's why when you are a kid, you can stand and pee. You will splash the pee at a distance, and it will come back slower until it reaches the level of the penis as a kid. But as you hit 20, you hit 30, once you cross 20, you cannot do that anymore. You cross 35, you're done. Sometimes you go to the bathroom and you're standing up, you want to pee, the pee cannot even come. But you have the urge. You have to wait for some time. But before then, before that age, the moment you want to pee, you go to the bathroom, you squat, or you stand up, the pee is released. So as you get older, the volume of urine we used to create to put out, that volume is reduced with age, and that age is from 35 upward. These things happen to us. Even like the way how we used to have sexual desire, the way how we got married. But we used to have 4 or 5 girlfriends, unless you are somebody different. But at that age, a lot of things will change in your life. Glucose tolerance, then diabetes mellitus, hyperlipidemia, all those conditions will begin to kick in because your body, your pancreas is not producing the requisite amount of insulin to work on your blood sugar. So when you eat, it takes longer time for the insulin to work on the blood sugar. These things happen in the middle of the age between 35 to 65. Now, Piaget also called this particular age range the former operation or ring. In this stage, reaction time and speed of performance slow slightly. The way how we react to things, the speed at which we perform our ADLs will start to change. We'll start to feel pains in our joints when we're waking up from bed, or we are moving around, or we do little work and other things, we'll feel intense pain in our body at this age. At this age, Piaget described this particular, Erickson. So Erickson described this portion as generativity versus stagnation. So we have what we call generativity versus stagnation. Stagnation. There's the conflict we are faced with when it comes to Piaget theories. Erickson. So when you look at those very operational age, operational problems, formal, all those one abstract, the fall under Piaget. When we talk about developmental stage conflict, it falls under Erickson. So Erickson said in this age, middle adults strive for generativities. They want to do such similarities in life. They want to use life as an opportunity for creativity and productivity. They have concern for others. They consider parenting an important task. It contributes to their well-being. They want to strive to do well in one's environment because reality has set in. At this age, things are becoming really clear to you at this age. If you did not catch up with your life below 35, when you cross 35, now things begin to set in. Try to see your life. Oh, wow. I must do this before I hit 65. Because 65, I'm going to be retired. What can I do with my life? So we sort of have these things going on. We want to start setting up ourselves. That's what we call generativity. We want to be creative under here. We want to start saving, like on the stock market. We want to engage into businesses, into long-term savings. Everything happens under here. On the other side, sometimes if we do not have the ability to achieve these things, we become stagnant. We become stationed one place. We cannot move ahead. That's when stagnation comes in. But the opposite of stagnation is generativity. We become creative. We do things that will benefit us in our old age because at this stage, 65, we're done with the war. These are things that are going to happen here. Now, so the view at this stage, the self-concept includes there will be menopause coming in. There will be sexuality problem coming in. There will be depression coming in. We become irritable. We become difficulty with sexual identity. Our job performance and ability to provide support will decrease. Our marital changes with the death of a spouse or divorce has a strong impact on us. A lot of things occur in this stage. Then our body image, our sex drive will decrease because our hormones that drive us to a higher sex drive will decrease also. So when those hormones that will make us to have the sexual erosa, when those hormones are decreasing, we will have a low sexual erosa or a low libido. We're going to have changes in our physical appearance. And sometimes our face will have those black rashes, those black marks on our face. Sometimes we lost our teeth. Sometimes our nose, our eyes, everything sort of change. Sometimes our lips, our face was shining, you know, look good. We sort of have like a wrinkles coming on our face. These things happen at this age. So at this stage, we want to make sure we keep in line. Nutritionally at this age, you want to see a nutrition counselor. You want to increase your consumption of whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables. At this age, some people can choose to be vegetarian or they want to eat certain diet because at this age, your health becomes your most paramount concern at this age. And we want to limit our fat and cholesterol. At this stage, we want to increase vitamin D and calcium supplementation for our health. These are things we want to do at this stage. We want to avoid drugs, alcohol, that might lead to substance use, substance disorders. We want to avoid driving a vehicle during or after drinking. We want to catch the Uber if we are going to a party that requires us to drink. These things will occur at the stage of the middle adult. Any question on middle adult? Then we move to old adult or older adults. This is the saddest part, sometimes the best part of life, 65 and above. 65 and above. At this age, we are retired. We are at the stage of our life wherein we're going to bear, we're going to reap, let me use the word reap, we're going to reap the fruits of our labor for the past years we live. At this stage is where if we work a good job, we have good savings, we enjoy our vacation, we enjoy our stay home, we enjoy our travel, we enjoy time with our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. At this stage, if we set up a good lifetime. At this stage, we start to have regrets if we did not go through our lifespan in the right means. This is the problem. This is where problem comes in. At this stage, there is so much decline. Our skin, there is a decreased skin tone. There is a decreased subcutaneous fat. There is a decreased tissues in our dermis and other things, which leads to wrinkles, dry and dry skin. We lost the moisturizing component of our skin. Our skin becomes scaly and ashy. The thickening of our fingernails and toes occurs during this stage. We start to have cardiovascular problem, hypertension, pulmonary COPD. Those things kick in at this stage. We start to have our sense of feelings, touch, and other things will decline at this stage. At this stage, there will be a great or a huge decline in our visual equity. At this stage, we want to have, we cannot hear sound from long distance, so we're going to have presbycopsis, deep increased ear problem with aging. We're going to have reduced spatial awareness. Our eyesight will become bad. We'll sort of have decreased metabolism. We'll have so many things not be decreased. Our teeth will have been increased dental problems at this age. At this age, our bladder will reduce in bladder capacity. We'll be exposed to having prostate hypertrophy in males. And we'll have so many decline in estrogen or progesterone production. We're going to have breast atrophy in the females. Our breast will drop and would lose breast tissues. Our breast will become smaller. The endocrine, there will be a decline in our thyroid hormone, the T3, the T4, the TSH. Those things will be declined. Then, this stage, according to PLG, is still regarded as a formal operational age. It's where we're going to have delirium and dementia coming in. In delirium is an acute, temporary, and can have a physiological source, such as infection, sleep deprivation. That's when we're going to have delirium. So we have delirium, and we have dementia. So for delirium, it is a short memory deficit. It's not forever, it's just temporary. It has due to infection. That's why when a geriatric patient, when you have a patient as an older patient in your unit or on your unit, in the nursing home or in a hospital, when a patient starts to have confusion, what comes to your mind first? is urinary tract infection or bodily infection. It comes in the anus a lot. Whenever a patient who is above 65 start to have urinary tract infection or any bodily infection, the patient will start to have mental confusion. They'll have decreased level of consciousness. These things can happen. So that's the first thing that comes to our mind when patients have short-term memory loss. Then we have dementia. Dementia is the chronic one. It is progressive. It is the one that has a gradual onset. It comes in at least 6 weeks and instead of progress, it is often due to the loss of loved one, feeling of allergy, or you have chronic disease condition. It occurs in dementia. So dementia is progressive. Sometimes, many a time, it has an unknown origin. It has different type. So in dementia, we have what we call the Alzheimer. So Alzheimer is a form of dementia that cause is unknown. So we have like a vascular dementia. This both vascular and Alzheimer dementia, the cause or the causes are unknown. There are some, the causes are not known. There are some, it might have an underlying cause. It might not have a root cause, but there's something that causes it to come in. Then the patient is going to have depression at this age. They will have depression, which is a chronic, acute, or gradual onset. It presents at least six weeks. It's due to loss of loved one, feeling of isolation. It could be a chronic disease in depression. Then at this stage, we have a conflict. At this stage, the conflict we have is what we call the spider versus integrity. It is not in here, but I know it's at this stage, we're going to know how we call disparity versus integrity. Now, integrity comes in when, like I said before, when your kids, those that you've taken care of, it could be biological, it could be foster kid, when you've done so much well, when you set up your companies, and at this stage you retire, you hear, Warren Buffett is retiring at this age, his son will take over the company. You hear Mark Zuckerberg is retiring, his son will take over this company, Facebook, at this age. You hear Bill Gates is leaving Microsoft. He got some out. Now, since the fam is retirement age, he wants to sit down. He does not want to be involved in the day-to-day activity of the company, which is very hectic. He won't just sit down and receive telephone calls and just look at computer screen and know the figures that you haven't going to his account. That's why you want to have this. If you are having that, meaning you are at peace, you are at what we call the integrity portion of this conflict. On the opposite, if life is not fond of you, you did not work when you were young, you did not go to school, you did not learn any form of professional trade or professional career. You live on doing McDonald's job once in the morning. When tax time coming, you run and do a few hours for a few months. After tax time, you quit. You get a tax return. You quit until the next year, November or December, you start to work. Now, at that point, at this age, you live on Social Security benefits, which everyone will have to get some portion. They give you like $300 every month. You don't have a house to own. Now, then you are in the street looking for shelter, have so many problems, and you stand by the store. Can I have a dollar? Can you help me? At that point in time, you will live in a complete disparity, wishing that your age can be reversed. You want to go back to your 18s so you can start to make things happen. At which point in time, it is impossible. So at this stage, 65 and above, we have a conflict called disparity versus integrity. This is where it comes from. Any question? So these are things we experience here. Head and neck includes the examination of the head, the neck, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, and the throat. So this is what we call the head and neck. From here going upward. That's the head and neck. So you got the head, the neck, the eyes, the mouth, the throat. Make up the head and neck. The head and neck. Now, this exam will include us assessing the skull, the neck, the face, the hair, the carotid arteries, the shoulders, the lymph nodes, the thyroid gland, the trachea position, and the jugular veins. These are all those aspects that are part of the head and neck we want to examine. During this period, we use techniques such as inspection. We use inspection. We use palpation. We use ultrasound. So we use inspection. We use palpation. And we use auscultation. Auscultation for the head and neck. Auscultation for the head and neck. Now, under here, we find things that we do not expect, or we look for things that are abnormal. In order to know things that are abnormal, we must know the normal aspect of what we want to find the abnormality with. So if you do not know the normal, you will know the abnormality. Under here, we use stethoscope to do our assessment. And what is important is that we test the following cranial nerve. There are cranial nerves that work directly with the head and neck organs. So here we'll be big on number one, on the cranial nerve. The cranial nerves. So you have to know this cranial nerve to your fingertip. You have to know them to your fingertip. Make sure and know the cranial nerve to your fingertip. Now, the cranial nerves during the head, you have cranial nerve that controls the head and neck. So you have three cranial nerves that control this part of the body. You have cranial nerve 4, cranial nerve 7, and cranial nerve 11. So you have the CN 4, CN 7, and CN 11. These are the cranial nerves that control most of the portion of our head and neck. There are other ones we'll talk about. Look at these three. Now, under here, you have cranial nerve 5. Cranial nerve 5, not 4. So cranial nerve 5 controls our head when we are doing facial assessment. Cranial nerve 5 assess the face for strength and sensation. So cranial nerve 5 is to the face and sensation of the face. Cranial nerve 5, which is the trigeminal nerve. So cranial nerve 5 is the trigeminal nerve. This particular nerve assess facial strength and sensation of the face. Sometimes when a client has stroke, they do not feel movement in the rest of the face. Or sometimes when the client has stroke, they do not have control over the rest of the face. You see the rest of the face dropping. You see the eyelid, the red eye close, the lips or the mouth get twisted to the rest side because they have lost the sensation, the neural power of the rest of the face. So they're going to have twisted lips, twisted mouth on the rest side. Then we have cranial nerve 7, which is the facial nerve. Now, this is the facial nerve. For cranial nerve 7, is called the facial nerve. This nerve controls the face. It controls the face and also assess the face for symmetrical movement. When you laugh, your two bust little move apart. When you smile, we see it. When you smile, your zygomaticum pushes up. You see the smile in your face. Our muscles will move apart when we smile. Meaning our muscles are moving in a symmetrical order because our facial nerve 5 is in tight, which is the facial nerve. On the other hand, when we have damage to the facial nerves, what happens to us? When we are laughing, when we are smiling, our one side of the face that is damaged cannot present the signs of smiling. So when we smile, we'll see our one side of the face movement, we'll see the movement, and the other side, there will be no movement, meaning we have a damaged facial nerve. Now, then we have cranial nerve 11. It's called the accessory nerve. Now, this accessory nerve, it is the cranial nerve that assesses the head and the shoulder strength. So when we are shrugging our shoulder like this, it is the accessory nerve that is the cause for us to do that. Now, we have to know these things by how they are being presented. Take for example, the ankles might bring it in different way. They might ask you, a patient, the doctor is checking the patient's shoulder, the steroid patient's shoulder is moving. What cranial nerve is being tested? You got to look at the cranial nerve. Or they might say, a patient was asked by the doctor. The patient did not make a verbal response, but rather he shrugged his shoulder. What nerve did the patient put into play? That is the cranial nerve 11. So we want to understand the 12 cranial nerves and their function on the human body. Then we look at the score. Check the score. The score is the side of the score. There is no depression of the skull. There is no deformity. There is no masses fell. There is no pain. Those are things we check for the score. Then we have the face. The face is, there are two nerves that take care of the face in general. Those two nerves are cranial nerve 5 and cranial nerve 7 are the two nerves for the face. Cranial nerve 5 and cranial nerve 7 are the two facial nerves that want to know about the face. They control everything about the face. Cranial nerve 5 tests the strength of the contraction of the face, and you ask the patient to clench their teeth together. So can you clench your teeth together? Yes. You see the strength in the face. That's how we test the facial strength. So if you were in the hospital and the patient fell from the bed, like I explained 2 weeks ago, so I tested the patient's strength of the face by asking, can you open your mouth? Let me see your mouth. Can you clench your teeth together so hard? And I will see the palpation, or I will see the movement of his muscles on his face. That's how you test for this cranial nerve. Then you have cranial nerve 7, which is a motor nerve. Cranial nerve 7 has a move. You tell the movement of the face, the smidge of the face, and you ask the client to smile. And the client smile, you will see the buccinator, the zygomaticus. You see all those facial muscles moving apart because the patient is smiling. This is how we test the patient, that the patient is undergoing these things, they are all normal. Then we have the neck. In our neck, we said we test our neck movement over our shoulder by what? Cranial nerve 11, which is called the accessory nerve. This accessory nerve, you place your hands on the client's shoulder. You stay from the back. You place your hands on the client's shoulder, and you ask the client to move his or her shoulder upward against your hand, placing a light force, pressing the shoulder downward. If the client can move the shoulder up and down with your hands on that shoulder going up and down, meaning the shoulders are in tight. So if you are involved in a motor vehicle accident, these are tests we do to know whether your shoulder and all those nerves are all working adequately. These are things we do. Now, then we have varial lymph nodes. Because the lymph nodes we talk about, the lymph nodes are also part of the head and neck assessment. So the lymph node, in the ankles, you want to understand what are the various lymph nodes and what are their location. It is important to know this for the ankles. You want to understand that chains of lymph nodes extend from the lower half of the head down into the neck. The lymph nodes extend from the lower half of the head in here, coming downward to the neck. That which we want to understand for the ankles. We also want to understand that we palpate each lymph node in a sequence when they are enlarged. The lymph node cannot be palpated when they are not enlarged with leg palpation, but once they get enlarged, we can palpate them to wherever they are located, to all the locations around our body. Now, we have the occipital node. The occipital node lymph node is located at the base of the skull. The first one is the occipital lymph node. It's located at the base of the skull. There where it is located. That's the first lymph node. The second lymph node is the post-auricular lymph node. It's called the post-auricular lymph node. This post-auricular lymph node is located over the mastoid bone. It's located over the mastoid bone. Now, then the third one is what we call the pre-auricular node. The pre-auricular node. This is located right at the front of the ear. So you have one at the mastoid, this is the mastoid bone behind the ear, and you have one located in front of the ear, somewhere around here. You can find it even the ear, it's called the pre-auricular lymph node. You have one we call the tonsillar lymph node. One is called the tonsillar or the tonsil, the tonsillar lymph node. The tonsillar lymph nodes are located at the angle of the mandible. This is the mandible. So at the angle, somewhere here, is where you have this particular tonsillar lymph node. Now, so when you look at from here, that's why sometimes when you have the tonsillar lymph node inflamed, you'll feel the pins from here coming all the way down because it's at the angle. So the mandible and the maxilla, so they join together at this edge. So at the angle where you see that joint, there you have the tonsillar lymph node. Now, then you have the submandibular lymph node, you have the submental lymph node, you have the anterior cervical lymph node, the posterior cervical lymph node, and you have the supraclavicular lymph node. So these are the kind of lymph node you have that you want to understand what these lymph nodes are located, where they're located in our body. And you have the gland. The thyroid gland, the trachea, other things. Then we have the eyes. Now we have the eyes. The eyes is also part of our assessment that we want to do when it comes to the head and neck. So we have the eyes. So the eyes are also involved in here. Now for the eyes, we will examine the internal structure of the eyes. The eye's external structure, the eye anatomical position, the eye visual field. We'll look at the eye's pathway. We'll look at the eye's ocular, extraocular movement and its reflexes. Those are components of the eyes we want to review. Now, for the eyes, we'll start with the various other findings, and to understand the abnormal condition of the eyes, you must understand the eye's normal condition. Let's start with visual acuity. The first one is visual acuity of the eye, visual acuity or acuity of the eyes. It does not matter how you want to call it. Now, we'll discuss the eye's visual acuity. We look at the distance of the vision of the eyes. That's one thing that is interesting to us. We look at the eye's vision, that's one. We also look at we use to determine the vision of the eye. We look at the distance of the eye, which is the Snellen chart. We look at the Snellen chart. The Snellen chart is one thing we look at. We look at another thing we look at over here is the Rosenberg chart. The Rosenberg chart, eyes chart. We look at what we call the Ishihara. The Ishihara test for color blindness. We look at the visual, near and far sightedness testing we do for the eyes. For the extraocular movement, the EOM of the eyes, we take a look we do a pin light or an otoscope light, and we cover one eye. So we take a pin light, cover one eye, and examine one of the eyes to figure out the extraocular movement of the eye, the eyes moving around. Move the eyes this way, go, we take the pin light, we put it in the eyes, and we move it around. As we move it, the client's head remain in one position, and the eyes move in those directions. We are moving the pin light just to make sure the client has good extraocular movement of the eyes, the EOM. Then we also look at some of the external structure of the eyes, also using the otoscope light, or we use the pin light. Sometimes we use the gloved hand to do that. We look at the internal structure of the eyes. We also use the otoscope to assess the eye's internal structures. Then we look at the cranial nerve. There are several cranial nerves that involve the eye's movement. Those nerves include, you have cranial nerve 2. CN2 is called the optic nerve. The optic nerve is one of the main nerves for our sight. Then we have cranial nerve 3. So this optic nerve is responsible for the eye's visual acuity. So if you went to the clinic to do visual acuity test, it could be using the distance chart, the Snellen chart, Ishihara test, and other things. All of those tests fall under visual acuity. And if you do visual acuity, you are testing the eyes. You are testing cranial nerve 2 for visual acuity. Then we look at cranial nerve 3. Also controls the eyes. It's referred to as the oculomotor. Cranial nerve 3 is called the oculomotor. Then we have cranial nerve 4. Cranial nerve 4 and cranial nerve 6 also has a part to play in the eyes. So cranial nerve 4 is called the trochlear nerve, and cranial nerve 6 is called the abducens. So 4 is called the trochlear nerve, and cranial 6 is called the abducens. So these nerves are nerves that take care of the eyes. If one of them is damaged, there is a problem with the eye sight. So cranial nerve 2 will look at mainly visual fields. Cranial nerve 2 and cranial nerve 3 will look at the cornea light reflex, and it will also look at pupillary reflection. So cranial nerve 2 and cranial nerve 3. And cranial nerve 3, they look at pupillary eyes reflection. How the eyes get adjusted to light when there's a light placed in the eyes. So cranial nerve 2 and cranial nerve 3 will look at the corneal light reflection. So you have cranial nerve 3, the oculomotor, cranial nerve 2, the optic nerve, give us the cornea light reflection. So these are things that we do. Now, then we look at visual equity in itself. Visual equity. Let's take a look at visual equity. How do we do visual equity tests? What are the findings and what's the result? How can we interpret the results of visual equity? That is also a concern. So for the visual equity, like I said, we are checking for what? Which nerve are we checking for when we do visual equity tests? Which nerve? Can anyone tell me? Which nerve is being tested for when we do visual equity tests? Can anyone tell me, please? Okay, so it's the optic nerve, right? So it's the optic nerve, and it is which nerve in numbering? It's cranial nerve number 2. So when you see visual equity, this should come to your mind, cranial nerve 2. Now, in visual equity, the client will stand at 20 feet. So we'll have an object, or we'll have the signaling chart, and the client stands at 20 feet. That's the first thing to tell the client. The client stands at 20 feet from the signaling chart. We evaluate both eyes and then each eye separated with and without separation. So the client will stand at a distance at 20 feet. The two eyes are open and we ask the client to identify letters on the chart from high to low or from low to high. That's one. After the client has identified those letters and the client stopped at a particular line, then we ask the client to cover one of the eyes and we test if the client covers the right eye, we test the left eye. After the left eye has been tested, the client covers the left eye and we test the right eye. We must test the both eyes together first and then we test the both eyes separately. Now, we ask the client to read from the smallest line to the biggest line or vice versa. The first number is the distance. Then from there, we provide the interpretation. So the first number in this visual equity, which we read as the numerator, represents the distance from where the client stands. Distance from the client's standing point or standpoint. That's the first distance. Now, the second number, which is the denominator, it is how bad it is. The first number is a distance in feet from where the client stands. The second number is the distance at which an unimpaired eyes can stand and still see the same object. That means if the second number is 30, meaning this first number represents the client, where he's standing, how far is he standing from the signaling chart. The second number, which is the denominator, gives us the distance someone with an unimpaired eyes, someone with a very good visual equity, can stand and still watch the same signaling chart. Take for example, pressure and I are standing from a distance. I have an eye problem and I can stand at 20 feet to watch a soccer game at a bar, at a sports bar in her area. But pressure, who has a good eye, does not have to stand at the same place. She can stand at 30 feet and still watch the same match and watch on the same screen that I have to stand like 20 feet to watch the match. So pressure has a better eye than I do. So the 20 up here is the distance from where the client stands to read a signaling chart. The second number, which is the denominator, it is the distance of someone with an unimpaired eye. The unimpaired eye expression is the one who's standing under here. So if we have a stunning chart and the result is 20 over 30, so we'll say Amadou can stay from 20 feet to see an object that someone with an unimpaired eye can stay at 30 feet to see the same object. Better still, if we have a visual evidence of 20 or 60, meaning Amadou with the impaired eye can stay at 20 feet to see an object, wherein the individual of the unimpaired eye will stay at 60 feet and still see the same object. So meaning Amadou eye is that bad. That's what it means. Now, over here, the Snelling chart is also used to screen client with impaired far vision. Client who cannot see from distance. They also use the Snelling chart. We call them myopia client. That is myopia. The client cannot see distance. He's short-sighted. He's myopic. Client who sees distance is what we call hyperopia, or is hyperopic. So you see two different kind of individual who read like this. One will read like this to see the writings on a paper, and one does not see anything or recognize anything when he brings the paper nearer to his eye at this level. So he has to carry the paper far away to see, like, oh, what is that? Okay. When you take it far away from your eyes, he can read them. But when he brings it to his eyes closer, he cannot read them. So the one who takes it far away from his eyes is hyperopic or hyperopia, and the one who brings it to his eyes so close to read is myopic, or he's suffering from myopia. Then we have the Rosenberg chart. These charts, these tests, you want to understand them and what can we do with their indication. We have the Rosenberg. The Rosenberg chart, it is an eye chart that we hold 14 inches from the client's face to screen for presbyopia. Presbyopia is eye problem with aging. Now, reading correlates with the Snelling chart. So the Rosenberg eye chart gives us the same value of a Snelling chart. Then we have color vision. The color vision test, we use what we call the Ishihara test. The Ishihara test, we do it when the client is fighting to recognize color. So it is the color blindness test. Color blindness. The Ishihara test is for color blindness. Then, this test assesses the color. The client should be able to identify the various shaded shapes. So, when it comes to the extraocular movement, the EOM, there are three cranial nerves that come to interplay. Cranial nerve 3, cranial nerve 4, and cranial nerve 6 for the EOM, the extraocular eye movement, EOM. Cranial nerve 3, cranial nerve 6, and cranial nerve 4 are the three nerves that work to give us think about the extraocular movement of the eye. For the visual field, the visual field of our eyes, where the client will look straight and will carry our hand like this. What am I doing on the side of your eyes? The visual field is controlled by cranial nerve 2. Just so you know that. Then you have parallel. For parallel, we'll do the parallel test, which is PERLLA, parallel. For the parallel, the parallel test, PERLLA, this parallel test, there are two cranial nerves that control the parallel test. These cranial nerves are cranial nerve 2 and Cranium 3, they both control Perla. And Perla, when we do a Perla test, is a numerical test we do to know that the pupil is equal, rounded, reactive to light and accommodation. So the P stands for pupil of the eye, E stands for they are equal, R stands for they are rounded, the other R stands for they are reactive, and the L stands for light, and the A stands for accommodation. So the pupil should be equal, rounded, reactive to light and accommodation. Meaning when there's a light, it should react to the light to create adjustment to see what's happening. That's why happens. So Perla is controlled by cranium 2 and cranium 3. If these two nerves are damaged, our pupil cannot be equal, they cannot be rounded, and they will not react to light or accommodation. You want to understand the nerve that controls these various body parts. So the pupils are equal if they are between 3 to 7 millimeters. The pupils, they are equal when they are between 3 to 7 millimeters, meaning they are equal. Any question? For the ears will look at various things. When you are doing the ear examination, you want to check whether the ear has lesions, whether there is the ear has drainage, or the ears are aligned. There is no tenderness on the ear. The ear are painless. You want to check that. When you check that, what is important about the ear? They include. There are tests we do for the ear. Those tests include one, the whisper test. Number one is the whisper test. Whisper test. This test is controlled by cranium 8. It's the whisper test. So when you hear cranium 8, we're talking about the whisper test. Now, the whisper test, how do we do the whisper test? You want to understand for the English how the test is done. In this test, we occlude one ear. We occlude one ear and test the other ear to see if the client will hear a whisper sound without seeing your mouth move. So you close one ear and you stand at the back or on the side and you talk to the client in a whisper. Come here. If the client does not see your mouth and the client understands what you're saying, that ear is good. Because sometimes when we talk from distance, we do lips reading, which helps us to understand communication a lot. So in the whisper, then the client will stand and the examiner will stand at the back or on the side. The client will occlude one ear and the nurse or technician will whisper and the client will interpret what was whispered. It is also done on the both ears to know. Then the next test is the Rhine test. The Rhine test. This Rhine test, in the Rhine test, use also cranium 8, which is the cranium 8. Cranium 8, we place a vibrating tuning fork against the mastoid bone. Under here, we are testing for bone conduction and air conduction. We have bone conduction under here.
that will have air conduction. Now, we use the mastoid bone for bone conduction, and we use in front the ear for air conduction. Now, so we have a tuning fork. A tuning fork is T-U-N-N-I-N-G, tuning fork. We use a tuning fork, it's like a Y shape. It's a copper metal. We vibrate it, we create sound, and you will hear the echo, you will hit it, and you place it on the mastoid bone. The bone is behind here. Either play like this, or you lay on the mastoid bone. Now, your body, your head will keep feeling that vibration. And you check the time, how many minutes you kept hearing that vibration. So when you put it on the ear, you mark the time at which it was placed on the ear. Let's say we did a bone conduction. It was 3:40. The client started hearing the sound. You tell the client, when you stop hearing the sound, let me know. So at 3:42, the client stopped hearing the sound. So the client heard the sound from 3:40 to 3:42. So the sound on the mastoid bone lasted for 2 minutes for the bone conduction. Then we placed the same tuning fork in front of the ear without touching the surface of the ear or the skin. It's just placed in front of the ear like this. At this point, we will hear the echo of this particular tuning fork. We hear the echo. So hearing that echo, we tell the client to tell us the time he starts to hear the echo. So he started hearing the echo from 3:43 to 3:44. So at 3:44, the client stopped hearing the echo. So this echo lasted for 1 minute. For 1 minute. So the client heard the sound on the mastoid bone for 2 minutes, and the client heard the echo in front of the ear for 1 minute. How do we interpret that the ear has a problem? Now, normally, we should have AC lower than BC. So the normal interpretation is AC meaning air conduction should be longer. It should be longer than bone conduction. It should be longer than bone conduction. So here we have BC. So BC is here as the bone conduction. So normally, in a normal circumstance, we'll do the mastoid bone and the air conduction. We should have a result that is air conduction will last longer than bone conduction. If we got this result, meaning the ears are good. If we got the opposite result, meaning the ears have problems. Take for example, in this case, the bone was 2, right? So BC here was 2 minutes and AC was 1 minute. So in this case, our AC was 1 minute, our BC was 2 minutes. So is this correct ear or bad ear? Are the ears good or bad? Can someone tell me? So we had for air conduction. Why is it bad?
Because the AC is shorter than the BC.
Thank you. So in this case, the AC is not longer than the BC, or the AC is shorter than the BC. So the AC is shorter than the BC, because the AC was 1 minute and the BC was 2 minutes, meaning the person's ear has a problem. So the normal result should be AC longer than the BC. But in this case, the BC is 2 minutes, the AC is 1 minute. So the BC was longer. So this individual ear has a problem. He has an hearing impairment. That's how we do the Ryan test. Any question on the Ryan test? Then we have the next test is the Weber test. The third one becomes the Weber's test. In the Weber test, it's just simple. We use the same tuning fork, we create a vibration, and we place the tuning fork on top of the client's head, right here. And we ask the client, do you hear the vibration of the tuning fork on the both ears? If the client says yes, the two ears are good. If the client says no, I hear it better on my left ear than my right ear, meaning the client's right ear has a problem. If the client says no, I hear it better on my right ear than my left ear, then the client's left ear has some impairment. That's about the Weber test. The Ryan test will use the mastoid bone and in front of the ear. The Weber test will use the what? The middle of the head with the same tuning fork. These are important tips for our NCLEX as we go along. Any question?